If I could stay up late, no doubt, I'd catch the buds just bursting out, and up from every hidden root would jump a tiny, slender shoot. So begins the poem, The First of May, by Annette Wynne. Ranchers and farmers may not all be writing poetry, but certainly they are living it every day. Our two guests sharing their passion and expertise this month are John Coleman Locke, a rancher who continues his family's tradition in specializing in purebred registered Brahmin cattle, and Hawaiian farmer Eddie Garcia, whose rebellious youth led him into the wilds of nature, the ancestors' know-how, and the importance of continuing and teaching these traditional ways. I'm Robin with Cultivated Audio for May 2023. So grab your earbuds and or a shovel and let's dig in. John, somehow I've fallen in love with the Brahmin breed doing some research for our chat, but it looks like there's a very large support group out there for addictions like this.
That's a good way to look at it.
Before we start talking about the Brahmin brand, please share some of the basics about your ranching operation in Hungerford, Texas, land, geography, rainfall, size, and the herd size of your YL brand.
Okay, sure. J.D. Hudgens Ranch is about 50 miles southwest of Houston. Our headquarters is just off of Highway 59, which is future Interstate 69. Little town called Hungerford, and our family's been there since about 1839, was when our ancestors settled there. So we're on the what we call the coastal bend of Texas, the Gulf Coast. We're not South Texas, and we're not East Texas. We're Southeast Texas, and you know how us Texans can be. We're a little bit particular when it comes to things like that.
Absolutely.
some people call it arrogance. I just call it, you know, let's make sure we get it right.
I know. I have cousins that we would visit in Texas, and ever since my cousin who became a lawyer, he would always have these court cases that we would have to play along with, and because Texas was seceding from the Union, for sure.
Right. Oh, yeah, definitely. So this is kind of a challenging environment that we're in. I know everybody's environments are challenging. Ours is just in a little bit different way than probably what most people in the U.S. deal with. And I say that because that's how the Brahmin fits into this whole scenario. Our ancestors realized early on that it was going to take a special animal to be able to thrive and make a living in this environment. And they ended up with Brahmin cattle somewhere around the turn of the century. They were experimenting with Indian cattle. They experimented with Hereford cattle. They did a lot of different things, making money in agriculture. And the Brahmin breed was the one thing that stuck. So I'm the sixth generation member of that business. Very large family. There's about 18 family members full-time in the parent company. Our lock division is part of that parent company. We're one of the eight divisions. The entire company altogether runs about 1,400 to 1,500 head of mama cows, Brahmin cows. My dad and I have about 200 Brahmin cows and about 75 crossbred cows at the moment. And what we are basically is a family-owned marketing co-op. So we commingle all of our cattle that we produce on our own properties in our own way together to sell seed stock Brahmin cattle to people across the country and people around the world as well.
Yes.
We're almost dead flat. People come here and get a little bit disappointed if they've come from hilly country or mountains. And we've got a lot of river bottom country that we operate on. Very, very humid and high rainfall, but undependable high rainfall, I would say. We have what we call flash droughts. The people in arid environments laugh at us because they think we don't know what droughts are. But if we go 60 days without a rain, things change pretty fast, and it's kind of odd the way this country needs a lot of moisture. But we typically get anywhere from 48 to 52 inches a year in a normal year, if there ever was such a thing as a normal year.
Right, yes. Something about that word. Well, considering the shrinking landscape of ranch land globally and concerns about water, raising Brahman cattle is probably making more and more sense. Is it becoming noticeably more popular since you've had a hand on the reins of your family business?
You know, the Brahman business, I'd say, throughout the history of the breed, which is just a little over 100 years old, it's got ebbs and flows. I can't say that it's dramatically different today than it was 20 years ago. I do think with the concerns about climate change and temperature extremes that you are seeing more of a renewed interest in heat-tolerant genetics, and Brahmins are pretty much at the top of the list as far as heat-tolerant genetics. And then you could take it all the way to the trying times and inflation and increased production costs and things like that. Crossbreeding and hybrid vigor is one of those things that's almost free in the cattle business. And so when you cross a Brahman with anything else, you get all the benefits of the heat tolerance and disease resistance and adaptability and all of that. And you get a lot more weight, and you get a lot more performance and production out of it. And that's not necessarily something that you have to pay for. So we have seen a resurgence in the need for Brahman since the 2011 drought in Texas, and things got really extreme. People realized how well they adapted and how well they performed through really dry times. But I say all that to say that I'm not going to take credit for any sort of a resurgence in the desire to use Brahman cattle.
No, you've just been on a steady road there between you and your six generations of family. It's great. And you said that when there was crossbreeding for that vigor that you talk about, you said you don't have to pay for it. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you take two dissimilar animals, two dissimilar parent animals, the progeny that you get from those dissimilar parents will exceed the production of either one of them. And so obviously you would have to purchase those animals, but if you take use as a reference just a pure Angus calf, and if you're talking about weight gain, reproductive performance, you say that Angus calf is the baseline, and then you take a half Brahman, half Angus, you get a tremendous amount of performance from that cross. It could be in the exact same environment, eating the exact same feed, having the same resources, not having to spend a dollar to make another $1.50, you know, not having to spend money on feed and supplements. You just get so much more from the cross.
Gotcha. So all of this, is it seen in the first generation of the crossbreeding, and does it increase as the generations go?
It is seen in that first cross. That's the highest level of hybrid vigor that you can get is from the first cross. It actually diminishes, and I'm not a researcher or a scientist, so I can't tell you all the percentages, but it does diminish somewhat in each successive generation. I think that it basically stabilizes at a point. You still do see a benefit, but not as much of a benefit as you do in that first cross.
Gotcha. And when I saw that they have great mothering instincts, I knew that they would be an intelligent breed. And I'm wondering, do you have any specific story that you could share about any of your cattle or cows that might speak to that, how clever or smart they are?
Oh, they're really, really intelligent. I'm trying to think of a specific story. It's not uncommon to see a cow with a newborn baby between her legs, her front legs, with buzzards coming in trying to peck the baby, or predators close by, and her just basically standing watch. I've seen that multiple times. They're highly protective. There's a concern from the human side on that as well, because if they don't know you and don't trust you, you could get yourself in trouble if you're unassuming and you're out trying to do something with the baby and the mother's there trying to protect it. She considers you a predator as well. Dealing with them on a daily basis, the way they think, they're very gregarious, so they want to be together. They have a very strong herding instinct, so they're very easy to move places and to send to different paddocks, and they know this place so much better than we do as operators. And we do see a noticeable difference between them and the crossbred cattle that we have and some of the other purebred cattle that we have. They're really fascinating. They're curious. They've got great personalities. And that's what tends to draw a lot of people to them. They have that real majestic look to them, but when you get around them and you see how they act and you see the way they think, and they love affection, and they really can get you hooked on them, I guess, for lack of a better word.
Yes, and it was curious to me just learning about them that the way they look, they have these folds of skin, and that actually helps them to live better in the heat, doesn't it?
That's correct. The fascinating thing about Brahmins is they're Bos indicus, whereas your European breeds and continental breeds are Bos taurus. The Bos taurus cattle dissipate heat through their lungs, just like dogs do. So basically they pant to get rid of that heat. And your Bos indicus cattle actually sweat. And so they have sweat glands under their skin. And so the more skin they have, the more sweat glands they have, and the more adaptable they can be to really hot, humid scenarios. So that's what all of that loose skin is for.
Now, would it be difficult for them to live in colder temperatures? What are the drawbacks of the Brahmin breed?
You know, I don't have my rose-colored glasses on today, so I'm not going to paint you this perfect picture that they're the end-all, be-all. And that is one of the major drawbacks. They do grow hair when they go to cold climates if they're acclimated properly. And so they can adapt to colder climates, but they're not necessarily well-suited to them. Now, when you cross them, when you have a half Brahmin blood or a quarter Brahmin blood, the negative effect from cold weather, I think, is negligible. I don't know if being in Canada in a blizzard, I don't know if I'd want to be a bovine in that environment no matter what.
Anyway, right? I don't want to be a human up there.
That's exactly. Exactly. But if you take a half Brahmin and put them in that environment, it's going to be hard on them. But with that being said, we have Brahmin customers in Canada. We have Brahmin customers in the Northwest and Oregon. And typically, they need some sort of shelter when the weather gets really tough. Mm. And then the rest of the year, they thrive. The other drawback would be that intelligence factor that we've already talked about. They take a different kind of handling. They take a conscious, observant person, maybe a patient person to deal with them. But when you have that, they're so much easier and so much better to deal with than other breeds I've found. But you also have the instinct, maternal instinct, and the predators, when they have babies, sometimes they can be a little harder to handle because they're very protective of them.
Right. Well, before we move on, I would be remiss, I think, if I didn't ask you about Manso's history. What do you think it was about him that just made him not only prolific, but just such a good breeder?
So I think Manso was the whole package. Back in the day, at a time when the breed was forming, which he came to the ranch in 1933, the American Brahmin Breeders Association was 9 years old at that point. We'd been experimenting with Indian cattle since the turn of the century. And the Bos indicus cattle are made up of four different breeds from India. And some of those breeds tended to be higher strung and have a little bit wilder disposition. They were lighter boned. They were lighter muscled. And Manso checked all of those boxes for us. Not only was he prolific and he was a real hustler and go breed a lot of cows and was a real sire and a real patriarch, he also had those traits. For the time, he was heavier boned, heavier muscled. He had a really good conformation, feet and legs and structure. But I think above anything else, he was a gentle bull, and he translated that gentleness to his offspring. And that's what Manso means in Spanish, is meek or gentle. So obviously he earned that name from a very early age, and our ranch became known for having the gentle, beefy Brahmins, and it was all on account of Manso.
Oh, that's great. And is this knowledge about Manso pretty world-renowned if you're into the Brahmin breed?
You know, that's a great question. I know the story of Manso and how he came to our ranch is pretty well known. I'm not sure if people really have a grasp on the history and the challenges back in those days and potentially the impact that single bull and our family had on the formation. I think our reputation and our cattle became known throughout the world, and it was because of Manso, but maybe people didn't necessarily associate that with the single bull. I've heard it said that anywhere from 75% to 95% of all Brahman-influenced cattle in the world have the, have his blood in them.
That's amazing.
Yes, ma'am. Pretty big deal.
I guess, yes. Well, as you mentioned, John, earlier in 2011, you did experience a big drought and you were kind of forced to rethink some of your methodologies. Now we're about 12 years later. What would you say was your most successful move or shift?
That's a great question. And that's pretty, you know, pretty much putting it simply and bluntly. I think this is going to sound like a cop-out, but just the willingness to step out of the norm, do things differently, make mistakes, and challenge most of the things that we held dear and thought, you know, were 100% the way to operate and the way to do things. Everything that we've done since then hasn't been successful, and there's always still going to be, you know, trials and tribulations, but just simply saying, okay, we are not going to continue to operate just the exact same way that we always have. If we want something different, we're going to have to do something different. That in itself, and taking on that mindset, I think is probably the number one thing.
Right. And so did that affect how you worked with your fields, or were you doing a lot of moving of the cattle back early on, back in 2011, and what has it looked like since?
So rotational grazing or cell grazing or any sort of managed grazing was basically foreign to us. We had set stock pastures that for all intents and purposes never would have had any kind of recovery or rest, fed quite a bit of hay throughout the winter and baled our own hay and those sorts of things. We completely transitioned to managed grazing, immediately quit baling our own hay and purchased it. The grazing was a real progression, I guess. You know, we started with probably four herds with five paddocks per herd. About 2 years in, without really having a lot of understanding of how the seasons worked and changes of management throughout the year and being able to be truly adaptive, we got into a little bit of a bind and things got dry. We combined all the cattle into one herd and started moving them, and that was sort of an eye-opener. Okay, well, we can do this. It's not that difficult, and we saw the benefit from that. And then we shifted to an extremely long recovery mindset and growing a lot of grass and a high volume of grass, and it didn't take really long for animal performance to suffer extremely with that sort of mindset and that management strategy. And so we wound it back completely the other direction and shorter duration grazing, lots of paddocks, multiple daily moves. Ultimately, I can say what I've learned from all of that is there's no one-size-fits-all management strategy for operating a ranch. There's things about our environment that are incredibly challenging and then things that we're really lucky that we have in our environment. And it kind of takes all the strategies to make it go. I quite often tell people that learning what to observe and then learning what to do based off of what you observed are the most important things. And probably before all of that, I could put planning, learning how to plan, and then learning what to observe and learning what adjustments to make based off of what you're observing. And that's all you can really hope for. Everything's not going to go perfectly. You're always going to be hit with some sort of a challenge. It's just a question of, well, what do we do based off of what kind of challenge we're facing right now?
Yes, observation is so key, I'm sure. And I was laughing the other day. I was in my ukulele lesson. This will relate. Hang on. And my teacher was showing some chord exercises. And he said, look at my fingers. And it's an economy of motion. And my mind went to, oh, that's what all the ranchers are doing with their cattle and their grazing fields. It becomes a big economy of motion for not only the animal's health, but that of the land as well.
It does. That's a really, really good way to put it. And it's all about energy. Every once in a while, when I want to mess with someone, and they say, well, what do you do if you meet someone on a flight somewhere?
Right.
Well, I'm an energy management specialist. And you know, think you're into solar or you're into petroleum or whatever. And I'm like, well, we are into solar. I mean, it's all about managing our personal energy, manage the energy of a large herd of cattle that take the energy from the sun and convert it. And it's just everything is energy. Too many times we forget that and get things kind of mixed up. But if you learn how to manage that energy efficiently, that's one of the keys, I think, to success.
Yes, absolutely. Now, John, what goes on in the springtime that makes your day or is unique, perhaps, to spring on the ranch for you?
I love the springtime. I've really learned so much more how to appreciate the seasons and the changes and, you know, the ebbs and flows of nature and life and all of that through the changing of the seasons. And springtime, we're really unique in ranching here, and some of it's through our grazing management, some of it's just through our environment. But we have a cool season flush and we have a warm season flush, and so when our grasses come on in the winter, late winter, early spring, it's a different community of grasses than what we graze in the summer. So watching that is a lot of fun. And that's also when our cows are flushing to get ready to calve. So the cows start putting on weight really, really fast. The grasses are growing really fast. We have to move the herds really fast. And calving is sort of right around the corner. Of course, we calve in the spring as well. And so that new life that comes on and all of that stuff is just a lot of fun. You start to see the trees bud. And it's almost like it's been winter, it's been miserable, we've had some cold, we've had some dreary days, and it's like going from that dreariness to that light and that sunshine, and it does get pretty exciting. Temperatures start to warm up, and you really start to feel that energy flowing.
Yes, I remember being in Austin for college, and on the opposite spectrum of spring and summer, when that first northern would come through, and you'd have to put on a flannel shirt, it was always so great and so appreciated.
Right. Oh, yeah. That's cool things off a lot.
Yes. Is there anything that you'd like to add that might either speak to the genetics one might look at when moving in the direction of having Brahma cattle, or anything in your experience that you might feel remiss if you didn't bring up because I didn't ask?
Oh, that's a great question. I think as far as the genetics go, you know, people that might specifically be breeding any kind of cattle, what I see in our business so my part of the business that I'm managing now is very unconventionally managed, but we still operate in a conventional world, and you can take the management. Well, so we're regenerative. We're grazing cattle, moving them frequently. We're managing our grasses for maximum energy, doing with much fewer inputs and things like that. And then our animal that we take from the system and go sell it, it might be going to somebody's place that's 100% conventional, that feeds a lot more grain, that doesn't rotate pastures. And so that person might not necessarily be appreciative. Our customer might not necessarily be appreciative of the fact of what we're doing with the ground.
Right. That must make you sad.
Go ahead.
I would imagine it would be sad to sell your beautifully taken care of animal to someone who's just going to give it grain or something.
Well, yes and no. And our customers are all very, you know, good people that would manage cattle really well, but in a different way. You know,
they're people that
care for cattle and the way they're handled and making sure their health is looked after.
Right.
But they just sort of see a different way to do it.
Yeah.
And so I think the one of the key takeaways for me is I've always been attracted to the extremes, and that, well, this is the right way to do it, and I like this. You know, whether you're talking about the genetics of the animal, the management of the land, so many times it's easy to get caught up in the extremes.
Yes.
And usually the truth and the best route lies kind of somewhere in the middle.
Well said. Yes, I agree.
So that's probably one of the main things. And if I go 100% all the way off the deep end one way, then I'm going to lose the ability to have be a positive influence on someone else that might be in the extreme the other way. So just kind of try to keep all of that in perspective.
So, John, what's your favorite steak?
Oh, that's a good question. It's pretty easy for me. It's got to be a ribeye. It's pretty simple. You know, the ribeye, you kind of get the best of both worlds. You got that nice marbling and juiciness and all of that good stuff. And it's just kind of hard to mess up a ribeye.
Eddie, you've coined Living Earth Systems as what you do, growing food in the tropics on Maui in Hawaii. And in these practices, there are different strategies than there are for the four season environments. Where would you like to start in sharing some key information which leads to successful tropical farming?
Okay. Hi, good morning, everyone. Aloha. So I want to point out first that in Hawaii, we're in sort of subtropics, not quite a tropical environment. A lot of people do relate to it that way. But once we get to the equator more, then we're like really in a whole different set of rules. Regenerative strategies and what I do with farming here in Hawaii is based on last 40 years of observation, experiments, fails, attempts, and learning from my mistakes.
How are rainy seasons and the dry season deciding factors as to when planting takes place? Is it naive to think that you can plant anything at any time on Maui or in the subtropical zones?
I don't know if I'd use the word naive into that. That's a tricky question because that's true and false. Where we have a rainy side that's on the windward side of the island, and we have a leeward side that's the dry side of the island, we have those conditions that exist at the same time. For instance, one of my farms gets 50 inches of rain a year, and the other one gets 2 inches of rain a year on the lee side of the island. So I'm growing in two completely different contrasting environments, even here within the islands. We're not as dictated by the time of year we plant like you guys are in a temperate climate, because you guys have the cold that's coming your way. You also have the sun hitting you at a different angle, rather than it hitting flat on the ground. As soon as it starts to shift more south, it's hitting the ground at an angle. So you just, your ground gets cold a lot faster. The core temperature from the ground moves up. We don't really deal with that either. For us, what changes the planting cycle is the light cycle. For instance, in December, the days are so short that anything we plant will only grow 6 to 8 inches and then go straight to flower. It'll complete its cycle really fast because the days are a lot shorter for things that are photosensitive. In the wintertime, we get a little bit more rain than the summertime, and that is on the windward side and the leeward side of the island. So we do pay attention to cycles, but I would say it's not that crazy naive to think that in Hawaii we sort of can plant just about any time. But the challenges we face in that as well are that the weeds are always growing. For instance, when we did a project in Southern California, we took a lot of the plants that we grow here in Hawaii, we grew them in the San Diego area. Most everything that we grew, including taro and sugarcane, did really well over there. But what was really amazing was the cycle of maintenance, where we would have had to cut the grass once a week with major weed eating and mowing. We probably only had to do it twice in an entire season there. Just the way that it's set up, the weeds don't grow as aggressively as they do in a tropical climate. Also, as far as pests go, we had probably 200 or 300 pests compared to maybe 5 pests that we dealt with over there. So I found that it was a lot easier to grow things in the mainland United States when the seasons were right. And I haven't dealt with the really high temperate zones, but in the 10, 11, we found that it was like really amazing. The soil is a lot older over there than it is here. Volcanic rock here has only broken down for a few million years, where there on the mainland, your rock is broken down for hundreds of millions of years. And there was areas where people assumed that the soil was dead because it was decomposed granite. All it really needed in it was organic material and life. And we were able to do really well growing things over there. And I would almost say, in some ways, it's a lot easier to grow in a temperate zone than it is here in Hawaii, because we face so many challenges.
So when you're working with water, for instance, you just mentioned you have two opposite conditions going on Maui, on your farms. Talk a little bit about water management when you have only a few inches a year as opposed to the 50 inches.
Well, for me, my strategies for managing water are, for the most part, underground. I'm a sort of a unique farmer that I don't bring in any fertilizers. I don't use any pesticides. And I have pretty much record yields here in Hawaii by doing it the way that I do it. I build piles and I introduce several different species of fungi. And once the fungi create this web of mycelium, then I'm able to charge the piles with water on the real dry side of the island. And the plants are able to actually use probably 1/10 of the water of conventional farming in the way that I'm set up. I also set up, instead of setting up in rows, the type of farming that I do, rather than planting conventional agriculture, which tends to be a monocrop, a single crop in rows, out in the middle of the field in full sunlight, my approach is more similar to something like permaculture. But it's not permaculture. It's just, like I said, what I've built through my own observation here in Hawaii, trying to use ancient Hawaiian practices involved with it. The idea of planting on contour, and rather than everything being in a field with no shade around it, actually there are trees in the scenario as well. So the crops are multiple layers of crops, root crops, small ground crops, small shrubs, larger shrubs, trees, and all of it is planted on contour, meaning that it goes with the flow of the land. Rather than straight rows where the water hits them, runs right down the rows, causes a lot of erosion, doesn't hold the water in the land. By planting on contour and creating things like swales, which are berms that will hold the water in place, between that and mulching and adding the fungi to rebuild the soil web, we are able to use about 1/10 of the water of conventional farming. The setup also does not require inputs like chemical fertilizers or even organic fertilizers. We're basically allowing what we have on the land by cutting, mulching, chipping, creating compost piles to create its own fertilizer on site. That also helps with the management of the weeds and the water at the same time. So the contrast between the wet side and the dry side, we use a very similar approach, but how we position the piles and how we position the contour to the land makes the difference that we're able to grow the same crops on the wet side as we are on the dry side. In some ways, it's even easier on the dry side because we have complete control of where we want our water. We're on the wet side, it's raining, and we have to deal with 80% more weed reduction and just other things that are happening because it is so wet. So there's slightly different managing strategies on the wet side and the dry side.
I'm trying to get a picture of what you're talking about with the contours. So let's go into what you do on the wet side of things. And along with that, the weed control, what do you do? Is it simply weed whacking or are there other strategies you have?
So I set my farms up in a way that's very similar to a natural forest, but also a combination of some lawns, some areas that are mowable, and some areas that are weed eatable. Between a combination of laying mulch down in piles so that weeds can't come through the mulch, and planting a lot of my major crops around hills that I create with mulch on them, I kind of break the whole farm up into islands of different shapes. Sort of. I know that it's hard to get a visual on that, but if you can imagine what a botanical garden would look like,
yes,
as a farm versus a field with row crops in it.
Right.
So a botanical garden in a natural setting where under a tree that's perhaps like for us, I plant an ulu tree and a coconut tree. And then I put a giant mound of wood chips and other trees that I've had to clear and stuff that would normally be going to the green waste. I set that up in a giant compost pile. And then I plant the trees and the other crops around the compost piles that are set up to the contour of the land, meaning using the topographical features that are there to lay it out in a beautiful garden, botanical garden setting, but super productive with food. And the reason that I do this is you don't have to feed a forest.
Right.
A forest in a perfect system in nature feeds itself.
Right.
Recreate my farms that way, that you wouldn't even know that there's a farm and not a botanical garden, but there's layers of food all around you. So one of these compost piles, it gets a breadfruit tree planted on it, which is ulu. It gets a coconut tree planted on it. And then all around the pile and underneath it, there are things like turmeric, sweet potato, chili pepper, gourds, squash, papaya trees, and different things last for different lengths of time. Papaya trees only last for a couple years, and they get planted out in different places in the pile. But then when they're chopped down, their entire root system and all of their trunks are eaten by the compost pile and fed to the trees around them. We also incorporate several species of earthworms into these piles and a lot of living creatures. And that's why we use the term living earth systems, is because a forest is a living earth system. The ocean is a living earth system. I mean, they're all interconnected with each other. So I try to think that way as I plan a farm out. I'll go into a piece of land and I'll observe it for over a year. I'll watch where the rain goes. I'll watch the areas that are dry and have dust, whatever the setting is, whether it's on the dry side or the wet side. It'll be quite a bit of time observing the layout of the land and then taking steps to work with what's there so that I can use its own systems that are in place to my advantage to bring them back into being.
That actually moves into and answers another question I was going to ask about knowing regeneration is always possible. I was going to ask you to share your first step in developing an area into a farm that has either been neglected or chemically damaged. And you just covered the first step, which is a full year of observation. Can you share an example of something that you've done where you've observed one thing and then made your move in action?
Oh, yeah. We have several demonstration farms here on Maui right now. And we do open tours to the public, and we do a lot of education here about regenerative agriculture. So this farm, for instance, it was a tomato greenhouse and a nursery for several years. The owner of it died. It went into a defunct area where a bunch of homeless people moved onto it. The nursery had cars parked in it. Greenhouses were just completely destroyed, some of them taken down. Massive amounts of trash, like you can't imagine. So most of these farms I've taken over have had just that in place. We've come in, I've observed what needs to be done, and then my very first stages are to pull the trash out, to start cleaning things. After I start cleaning things and whatever kind of trash or plastic or anything that's been left over from agriculture that uses plastic on the ground or anything like that, I clean it up, I bring it back to nature, and then through those observations of the year, I start to find what is contour. How does the land want to run water through it? Where does it want to go? And so then where I see where it wants to go, I start to create a contour shape with the land. As I do that, I also start to take all the plants that are rubbish, that are invasive, that are not good, and I take them and I cut them down and I put them into a wood chipper, and I turn them into these giant piles of wood chips. Now I spread these wood chips everywhere where I have issues within the contour. At the same time, I throw logs with several different mycorrhizal fungi in there. I throw those in the pile. Then I throw earthworms, isopods, copepods, roly-polies are copepods. And I throw a bunch of different life into the scenario. And then I throw things like beans and legumes and different plants, native plants from the area. I start to just kind of throw them everywhere as I shape it on the contour. I've cleaned the trash out of it. Now I've started to look at that contour, and then I make a plan of how I want to plant it. Once I have the plan in place to plant it, then I start to plant things, put water on it, and over the next year, I create a maintenance plan. I create, how does the flow go? Am I going to mow this? Am I going to weed it? Is this area going to stay full of wood chips? Am I going to shade this area out with some trees so I can grow a different type of ground cover here? And then I throw ground covers on the ground everywhere. And most people would just think grass or lawn, and there is a bunch of different grasses that grow in, but I start out with a bunch of different native legumes and ground covers that should be in the area. And that promotes beneficial insects and a whole lot of other things going on. And so this is a course of over a year, and that kind of explains this place that I'm at right now. And I'm going to give an example where when I first came to this place, which is 17 acres, it's right on the ocean. It's at the bottom of the base of the West Maui Mountains, which have been completely deforested from bad agriculture in the past, sugarcane and the cutting of the sandalwood trees. So there is absolutely incredible amounts of erosion running off the mountain, running through the property and straight into the ocean. So I watched that for the first year, and I realized how much of that was going and smothering our reef system. To me, regenerative agriculture takes care of the environment around it.
Of course.
Takes care of everything. You look at the whole. I've traveled as a surfer and a kite surfer for many years and made my living that way, as well as farming. So I tried to pick up whatever I could learn anywhere I was at in the world. And I started to notice in some areas they were using vetiver grass and swales and different things to keep sediment out of the ocean. So with that knowledge, my first observations were that there was hundreds of tons of sediment going into the ocean. So one of the very first things I did is I was creating the land on the contour. I created a dip and a couple swales. And when the big rains came, and we had the wettest year we've had in 10 years here right now, I collected 100% of that silt, deposited on the land into my compost piles, and I collected 99% of that water that was flowing the hill through swales and allowed it to feed the water table of my orchards here.
Beautiful.
With this farm, there was also some 18-year-old orchards, but the entire place was completely smothered out with other giant trees. So the orchard looked dead, 50 different types of mango trees, there's hundreds of coconut trees and other fruit trees. So I had to take out thousands of 40-foot tall invasive trees. Bright side of that is I got all these massive piles for compost and swales.
Yes.
So I've pretty much turned this place in the course of 1 year from being the most incredible dump and funked out place to it's mind-blowing. There's thousands of pounds of fruit on the trees right now. What we can do in a year, we can take something that's been damaged for hundreds of years, and in the course of a year or two, by thinking it out for the year before, we can regenerate that place and turn the tables within just a few short years. I have another project right down the road, which it was completely deforested dust bowl, and we've used the same practices there in the 2 years before I took this farm over. And within the first 18 months, we were able to grow over 200,000 pounds of food. We've changed the landscape completely. There's no more dust. We put in trees and plants in place to control all the erosion there as well. So between the two farms this year, we probably kept about 300 tons of sediment out of the ocean.
You didn't mention on the place where you're at now, putting trees in by the coastline. Is that something you did or didn't do and why?
We do plant trees and stuff by the coastline. In fact, we have a nonprofit, which is Regenerative Education Centers. And within that nonprofit, we want a program that we call the Sea Trees Program. The Sea Trees Program is run by another nonprofit, Sustainable Surf. They're there on the U.S. mainland. They plant mangroves all over the world and restore coral and different things like that. And so we have a project that's set up for the watersheds over here where we do reforestation in the watersheds. And also a lot of that for us is coastal watershed. So we plant native plants like such as Milo and coconut, some of the voyaging plants, and different things that control the erosion, they catch the sediment, and they keep it on land and don't allow it to get into the ocean.
Yeah.
So that's one of the projects that we have running, and we try to inspire other farmers to think that way.
Sure.
You're farming, you're going to make an impact, so why not try to do things that are mitigating any negative impacts that you could have? And it also sets a great example for other farmers to take on some of these practices.
Definitely. So, now, are livestock part of what you do?
I do limited livestock as well. In small areas, I'll run a 12-acre paddock into 2 acres, and I'll rotate 4 or 5 cows together. And that will allow them to leave quite a bit of manure behind and manage some of the grasses in the fire areas. Then we'll keep them moving all of the time for the purpose of sequestering carbon, eating grass, turning it into poop, putting it back into the soil. So we do manage a few animals out that way, sheep as well, and a couple other things.
Now, regardless of farming environments, farmers have lessons learned and lessons shared. Do you have one to share that comes to mind that either came from a totally different environment or just something that you at one point thought, oh, this is the greatest idea, and then realized, oh, maybe not?
Lessons learned. Maybe one of my mistakes somewhere that I've done. Let me think about that for a little while. I make so many mistakes constantly just in normal practices that most of what I do now, I've been doing for so long, it's almost hard to remember mistakes that I've made. As a child, over here, the university, they did not have an organic program. So all they taught people to do was to till the land, add lime to the soil to balance the pH, and then throw chemical fertilizer in it. They also taught people to put down black plastic and cover the ground so they didn't have to deal with weeds. And in the very beginning, I want to say once or twice, I probably tried that as a kid, and it instantly got me into arguments with the university. What are you guys doing? The Hawaiians didn't do this. They were using hau and milo leaf, and they were mulching. And so I chose to challenge that, and I went on to know them because it didn't work for me. When I put the black plastic down, it got ants underneath it that would harbor the mealybug. It would solarize the soil and bring it up to 220 degrees and make it hydrophobic. So now I'm watching all these fields around me everywhere, and they're laying black plastic on the ground everywhere. Hmm. And so they're managing the crops with herbicide. They're using chemical fertilizer. That's a great mistake, because that's what supposedly my mentors, the universities, were handing out at the time as of when I was a kid. And to me, it's completely wrong. It's completely detrimental. And if we look that we can cover the ground with mulch and we can use different approaches rather than something like that, I want to say that's probably one of the biggest mistakes I see happening around me, is looking at some of those practices that conventional agriculture carry. Right. And the reason for that is you can grow food with chemicals and that type of farming, but you cannot grow soil that way. I think that's a good one.
Yeah, and when you grow good soil, that equals resilient plants, and that equals nutrient-dense food. So you can grow food, but, you know, let's get the BRICS meter out, right, and see how it's doing.
Yeah, so we have done through the years lots of nutrient density testing, and we're higher on the scale than anything I've ever seen, astronomically so.
Congratulations.
And part of it is the not using as much water in some of the areas that we are, but what really is the diversity of how food is supposed to gather nutrients from the planet. It's a system like a forest that feeds things, and it does take companionship, and it takes root systems, and people are talking about mycorrhizal fungi, but I think there's a lot being missed that we're going to find out in the next few years, I have no doubt, because it took me several years to find our mycorrhizal species here in Hawaii, because we're so limited, that here it's set up, it's a lot bigger than just the mycorrhizal. There's hundreds of different, thousands, if not millions of different species of fungi that interact with each other, and it creates a web. And even the plants that don't have mycorrhizal relationships are still massively benefiting from these webs of mycelium that are going on. And then when we test the nutrient density and the drought resistance, how are we able to farm on a tenth of the water of conventional farming? That goes down to the biodiversity and what's really happening underneath our feet that we're forgetting about. Conventional farming, we till the land. We break that all up. We do zero tilling. Everything gets planted, and its roots are the tillers, and the insects are the tillers.
Yes.
So I think that speaks pretty loudly to nutrient density. And when plants are growing and they have that diversity, it's a whole different set of stuff that they're bringing in and they're feeding themselves with.
Absolutely. Now, I'm going to switch topics on us here to finish out, Eddie. Yep. Being a surfer and world-class kite surfer, your thoughts have naturally leaned into keeping the ocean clean as part of course, this whole ecosystem. Tell us about the styrofoam-eating worms you've become familiar with.
Yeah, I'll give you a kind of a quick story if I can do that and tell you the whole story. So many years ago, I used to take Yvon Chouinard from Patagonia, the owner of Patagonia. He would come back and surf on the backside of one of the islands with us in some secret spots. And he brought some of the first EPS styrofoam surfboards. Clark Foam had just went out of business, and they were getting out of the polyfoams. So he told us the boards were unbreakable. We broke them in a week, and then they wound up staying with me on Molokai, where I live in a remote valley. Had them in my yard, and one day I went to the health food store, and I picked up some oats, and they had a couple of beetle larvae in them. I was curious what they were. I was using them for composting, so I set them in a styrofoam container, and they ate through the styrofoam container. So those boards were there that Patagonia had given us, and I put them in a box with these beetle, and they started eating the boards. So I was like, wow, this is pretty incredible. They're eating the boards. So then I started to do a bunch of different experiments and seeing if I could break it all down into compost and actually grow different plants with it. And yeah, I was pretty successful with that. Years later, Stanford did a study on a a similar beetle larva, which is from the common mealworm. And they released that, and I got massive coverage with what was going on with that. Turns out the worms that I had been using from the super beetle, the super worm it's called, they were 100 times more successful at it. So I started setting up things where I would go travel, I would break a surfboard. I would even go to some place I'd travel and broke a surfboard before where it was stashed, grab it, bring it back with me, put it in a bin, and have these worms eat it and break it back down into soil. So, yeah, it's pretty promising as to what can happen. Nature has evolved to deal with anything that comes out of the earth. There's a way to bring it back into the circle. I want to point out that since that happened, a lot of people have just tried to grab mealworms and put styrofoam in with it. That's a little bit of letting the enthusiasm get ahead of the facts. It's a complicated process that I've created. The worms eat it, and then I initiate some fungal material on it, and the fungi breaks it down. And then after the fungi breaks it down, I feed it to creatures like copepods and earthworms. So it's several layers take place.
Perfect.
And then the end product is just a completely composted material. And so what I was doing was growing things like flax grass, and then they could actually turn that into a normal glassing material. And then they were taking a bioresin and putting a bioresin and actually able to make a surfboard with me out of the old surfboards that were
nice.
Not recyclable. And, you know, surfboard styrofoam lasts for thousands of years on the planet.
Right.
So to have a way to be able to do what I was doing and having fun and making a living, going all around the world, to be able to push that to others and say, hey, maybe we can think of some solutions from nature that are already there, even for things that we don't see. So 2018, I think Surfer Magazine did an article on that. And that was really cool for me to bring it into the group of people that I'm with, you know, my little niche.
Right.
Surfers should be ambassadors. We get to travel and we get to see most of the beautiful places in the world. And most of the places we go to are absolutely littered with styrofoam and plastic. We get to see it firsthand, unfortunately. It also gave me an opportunity within Surfer Magazine and within what I do to also really push regenerative agriculture to the folks that are also somewhat ambassadors of stewardship on the planet.
Well, maybe there'll be an influx now of Brahmin cattle over in Hawaii. Thanks today to John Coleman Locke and Eddie Garcia. I'm Robin Clare at cultivatedaudio.com. Thanks to all of you for being here and for helping make here where we all want to be.